Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
My name is Garth McKenzie. I've been trading since the age of 16. I headed up the retail derivatives desk for a large stockbroking firm in South Africa from 2003 until 2009. After that, I left the corporate world and I started traderscorner.co.za, an online service that caters to DIY traders, providing analysis and trader education. I also ran the Traders Corner TV show on Business Day TV for over 10 years, from 2009 to 2019. I've recently relocated to the UK and I trade both the South African and the offshore markets. Through this series, we hope to connect traders with other traders across the globe to share information, tips, and general advice on derivatives trading. The podcast series is brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. On to today's episode. Joining me on the podcast this afternoon is Greg Davies, and Greg is the head of wealth and head of wealth at Kratos Capital. And Greg, I look on your Twitter profile and I see on the top of your background image on the Twitter is a image of the JSE floor. And I know you've been around the market for a long time. I presume you were on the floor back in the day. So welcome, Greg. It's good to chat to you.
As well, Garth, thank you for the opportunity. Nice to be in touch again. That's actually a painting which I think is hanging in the new JSE building of the trading floor from back in the day. And you kind of look at it and you know it's sort of based on a photograph and recognize some of the faces there. But that's actually where my career started. I was very fortunate that my dad was a stockbroker at a company called BC Davies and Company. And once I finished my national service and finished studying, I desperately wanted to get into the stockbroking game. But my dad, he realized how tough it really is. And he tried to dissuade me for quite some time. And then eventually we came to agreement. At the time, he had a farm out at Hennops River. And he said, if you work on the farm at the weekends, you can come and work at the stock exchange during the week. After putting up with the farm for a while, I actually grew to love it, really. And obviously, the stock market's been in my blood. I can remember sitting around the dinner table with my dad telling me stories of things that happened on the trading floor and having a good giggle. So stocks and shares were something we spoke about from a very young age in the Davies household.
Yeah, brilliant. Like father, like son. So more or less, when was that you started trading on the JSE?
Yeah, I'm going to sound like a grandpa now, but it was around May or June of 1989.
Okay.
I actually remember the day. The first thing I did was there was a firm called Rice Rinaldi, and they were listing a business called Aurora Granite. And I was tasked with holding a video camera and filming those days when a new share listed, it was quite a formal process. Someone would ring a bell and the share trading would start. So I made a recording of that. And it was kind of nice to, the first time you're on the floor, it is quite an intimidating place. And at least I had a camera in my hand, so it looked like I had something important to do.
But those days on the floor were a lot of fun from guys that I've spoken to. I mean, I only joined the market formally in 2001. So by that stage, the floor had long since closed. But you're chatting to older guys in the market, old stalwarts, the likes of yourself and other well-known figures in the industry, it seemed like those days on the floor really were golden, and you had a lot of fun back in those days.
Yes, a lot of fun, a lot of characters, a completely different way of trading to what we're doing now. You had, grizzled old traders that had been there for years, and you had sort of almost a hierarchy where there were certain people you'd have to go and greet them each morning and say, good morning, Mr. So-and-so, good morning. Otherwise, sooner or later, someone would come and give you a punch on the shoulder and say, why didn't you come and say good morning? And obviously, you had your bigger broking firms, which would have a team of traders, which would, each one would specialize in a sector. And if you were a smaller broking firm, as a trader, you'd have to get in and mix it with people that, were dominating in a certain space. So a lot of relationships were made there. People were taken out for lunch and that kind of thing. And also, a bit of a drinking culture as well. We used to always say, if you the Red Room, which was the members bar, was on the same floor as the JSE trading floor. And if you walked past the pub at 4:30 in the afternoon, in those days the market closed at 4, you could tell how good the market was, but the volume of noise coming out of that pub could tell you if it'd been a bull market or a bear market that day. But I miss it, I must say. It was a lovely time, and you basically knew everybody in the stockbroking industry. People would change firms, but you would still be in touch with them. And when it was first sort of promulgated that we were going to go into a computer-based trading, we were a bit reluctant, really. And some of us thought, well, you know, it's certainly the way of the future and what have you. But it'll level the playing field. It'll make things more honest. But I do miss the guys, I must say.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I mean, all getting together on the floor, being in the same place every day, seeing each other, it builds a nice camaraderie. So I can well imagine. And I must say, I'm sorry that I was not around for those days in my own career, because it does sound like it was a great deal of fun. But now, Greg, you trade for yourself, but obviously you also, you're head of wealth at Kratos Capital. So you've got a book of clients that you also trade for. And before we started the recording, you were just telling me, you know, some of your, the bulk of your clients are long only, but you also do a fair amount of active intraday or short-term trading, both long and short. But if we were to just go back a bit in your early years, I mean, I suppose it's in our blood, all of us that are involved in the market. We all trade for ourselves. We all trade for our personal account, our PA. Did you start right in the beginning, those days when you were on the floor, did you start trading for your personal account at that stage as well?
Yes. I mean, I suppose, you know, the bug bites you straight away. A movie came out about 10 years ago called Molly's Game. And the theme of the game was a woman she was going to be a professional skater in the Olympics, and she hurt herself. So she started up a poker tournament. But one of the lines, which I'll never forget from the movie, it said, money which is won is twice as good as money which is earned. And so anyone who's been bitten by the trading bug knows that even if it's 5,000 Rand that you made with a clever trade, the amount of pleasure that gives you is almost the same as 50,000 Rand that you had to really work hard for.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's right. I mean, I can certainly attest to that, being in the market. And I also know that the losses also hurt like hell as well.
Sure.
I always think, you know, a 5,000 Rand loss hurts a lot more on a relative basis than a 5,000 Rand gain.
Yeah, it swings both ways.
It does. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Does. But when you started trading for your own account back in those early years, what was it like? How was your success? Did you do well from the outset, or did you struggle in the beginning? Because a lot of us, I mean, myself, I battled in the beginning, and you read a lot of trading books and guys blew up one or two or three accounts often in their early years, particularly if they're trading leveraged instruments. But I mean, you would have, I would imagine, started with straight stocks. There wasn't really any futures or CFDs back in those days. But what were your first couple of years like as a trader?
Do you know, in an odd way, and I just sort of thought occurred to me right now, in some ways, it was almost the other way around. I was the broker who was effectively going onto the floor and executing the trades. But the clients at that point were obviously more knowledgeable than myself. And my dad's firm, and then I joined another firm called Kahn Shapiro, had a base of wise old clients that had been in the market for years. And talking to them, and obviously now you're executing the instructions, they were actually like professors in university. You learned more hands-on, and you actually physically did the trade. And they would explain why they were buying a particular stock. They'd been to a shareholders meeting, that heard of this. And often you'd go off and have a coffee with them after work, and you would actually learn more. It shouldn't be that way around, but you would, obviously, as a broker, you know all the technical side. But the psychology of trading and investing and that kind of thing, you actually learned a lot from your clients. I would say the first 4 or 5 years, I learned more from listening to clients and watching how they traded and why they traded than actually anything you could learn in a textbook.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I can also sort of understand that. My career also started out in a broking firm, and likewise learned a lot from other people's mistakes, actually, which I suppose is
fortunate
in some respects.
Yes, you learn a lot. Yeah. Yes, sure. That's the thing. You see people making blunders, and you think, that seemed like such a good idea, and then you learn. And also, sometimes you think something is a great idea, and the clients will say, listen, you haven't thought of X, Y, and Z, and so on. So It's a sort of symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. What I also found with having clients when I was in the firm, when I was running the trading desk at BOE, is actually you've got a whole lot of extra pairs of eyes out there in the market looking for opportunities. Yes. You know, you've only got two eyes of it, whereas if you've got a book of clients, they're all looking for something, and often they might spot something that you didn't see. So that can be quite helpful.
Yes, and they're often in various industries. They might be in mining or something, and they understand the sort of the background to what you're trying to do in investing and so on.
Hi, everyone. Once this series is complete, there will be an ebook of the series that will include transcripts from all 10 episodes and a couple of surprises. If you'd like to receive that ebook for free, then all you need to do is click on the link included in the show notes to register your details. Alternatively, also find that link on our Facebook page. The free copy will only be available to the first 350 subscribers. Back to today's episode.
I had a client who was, interestingly enough, a doctor up in Rustenburg, where all the platinum mines were. And he would know which platinum stocks to buy. And I'd often think, you know, sometimes some of his patients must have given him a couple of heads ups on what was happening hands on the mine. So that type of thing, invaluable in those days.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, I mean, now coming more to the current time, I mean, as you say, markets have moved on. There's no longer the floor. We trade on screen. It's there's algos at which some guys absolutely hate. It's the market's very different. But what is your sort of primary strategy now in terms of how you trade when looking for shorter term trading opportunities?
Yeah, I think as you say, that algos is a big thing, that the flows of the MSCI, when they're buying emerging markets, when they're selling them. And so, and I feel sorry for everyone who's gone and studied a CFA, but it feels like the last 12 months, the fundamental analysis has become less and less important, and it's become much more macro. And what I do, you know, as a basic theme is I look for situations where bad news comes out and the stock or the underlying stock market doesn't react negatively. And it's been such a good example. These last two weekends, we've had obviously Moody's downgrade us, and the Rand initially weakened and then came back, and then the market didn't collapse. And then obviously you had Fitch this Friday, which gave us more or less the same thing. And again, the market didn't fall back. So twice the market was telling you a lot of bad news is already priced in, and a dose of really bad news comes out and a stock doesn't fall or a market doesn't fall. For me, that's a sign to go into the stock. I do believe in technical analysis, and I do think before you buy any stock or do any trade, spend 30% of your time that you're going to do thinking about the trade, looking at the technical analysis, looking at the volumes, looking at the support levels. Some of our stocks have become so complicated to trade. I'm thinking of things like NASPAS and Prosus, that to try and understand the fundamentals is too complicated now. So I really rely heavily on technical analysis, support levels, breakouts, when stocks are back on a support level, they break up or down from there.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's very similar. I agree with that. And I think that fundamentals ultimately do win out in the long run. But technicals are what measure the market's sentiment in the short term. And for that reason, likewise, I'm also very much a technically driven trader. And I think that your technical analysis is probably the best tool of measuring that market sentiment. And it will give you a great deal more insight than any sort of deep fundamental analysis will do for a short-term trader, I'm saying.
Yes. If you're on the spot, on the moment, if a client's saying to you, do you think we should buy XYZ at these levels, I'll always pull up at least a three-month chart and have a look, you know, where the stock's been trading, where the volume's being done. The volume's very, very important. And then sort of form a picture in my mind of where I think it's going forward from there.
Yeah. And your time frame on trades, you know, because every trader has a different style, or there's not one size fits all kind of model. I mean, some guys are very ultra short term, trade the market intraday, job it in and out several times a day and go home flat at the end of the day. And then there are others that take a sort of a more medium term type of approach. I certainly fit into that latter camp. What is your outlook? Do you trade, ultra short term? Are you sometimes an intraday trader, or would you say most of your trades are more than a couple of days?
Yeah, Kratos, where I work, was originally founded as a proprietary, a day trading operation, and I would say 80% of the people there are day traders. And I think my initial idea of joining Kratos was I'm going to be in a room with 40 day traders. Obviously, I can't copy their trades, but you'd have that pool of knowledge of people that are trading shorter term, and ideas would come up all the time. And then why not use those ideas and offer them to private clients to trade, obviously trade for myself. So I've do a little bit of everything. I mean, today, I think we were chatting earlier, we're both trading Sasol like crazy, but I left at the end of the day without a position, but I traded Capitec, I traded Sasol, I traded First Trend. So I do a little bit of short-term trading as well. And then I keep some things for like 2 weeks, you know, things like Sibanye, the gold shares, the platinum shares, that type of thing. I do sort of a 2 month basis. And then I've got some other very sort of long term, sort of deep macro kind of ideas, which I put away for a couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. And when it comes to risk, how do you approach that? And I'm thinking here more particularly with your shorter term trades, because obviously we all, you know, get it wrong occasionally. We like to get it right, and the secret in this game, I suppose, is being more right than wrong, and being and making more when you're right than what you lose when you're wrong. But there are different approaches to risk, and you know, the standard thinking with trading is that you never risk more than 2% of your capital. Some guys say that it's, you know, less than that, that 1% is the right number. How do you approach risk? Are you as rigid as that in terms of where you would put a stop loss, or how much money you're willing to lose on a trade, or how do you approach risk?
Yeah, the one thing which I think maybe I'm a contrarian in this, but I don't really believe in hedging. Someone I was reading an article said hedging is for gardeners, really. You've got to have some risk, really. But yeah, I think the basics are there. You know, make sure, especially if you're trading on contracts for difference, make sure you've always got plenty of margins. If I short a share, I'll always look to where it was at its all-time high, and I'll make sure I've got enough money. If it retraces to that, then I'd still have enough margin where I won't be stopped out. But yeah, I think sort of 1 to 2%, you know, of your capital on each trade. But it's almost like each share's got its own personality. So I sort of mold my thinking to each particular situation. I don't have that really hard and fast rule. A lot of it's guts and looking at the screen at the moment.
Yeah, that gut feel, I must say, it's something that I think those of us that have been around in the market for a while, you know that's, you can't teach that. It just takes time and experience to develop that gut feel. We were talking earlier before we went on the recording, and you mentioned Sasol. And we're recording this today. It's the 8th of April, for those that are curious. And if you go and look at the trading history in Sasol on the 8th of April, you'll see that it was the most incredible movements in that stock today. I mean, it traded a range from, 50 Rand up to 85 Rand, I think, during the day today. And
where in the world does a top 40 share move in that? It's trading like a penny stock. And I mean, from Monday morning, the market cap is 20 billion. By Tuesday afternoon, it's 50. By mid-morning on Wednesday, it's back to 40. So, I mean, you are moving billions of rands worth of market cap in and out. And I think we were saying before, it's got to be a story behind this. Something's, you know, what always happens with these dramatic moves is we're all puzzled by them. We trade as well as we can. They don't make any sense. A little bit of luck involved, but in a week or two, the story will come out. I think with Sasol, it's fairly clear that they're going to need some sort of rights issue or some way of raising more capital. And so I think the professionals are all saying, be careful of Sasol. And a lot of private clients just went wading in there, and they were right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been an incredible stock to trade lately. Greg, obviously all of us as traders have a story, and we've got our story of our best trades and our worst trades in our careers. Do you have any specific trades that stand out for you in all your years in the market? Let's start maybe with the best, and are you able to share that with us?
Yeah, I suppose it's definitely the best trade I've ever done, but in a way it's got a sort of sad ending.
You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider.
If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes.
I was working for a company called Greenwich, and the company was doing really, really well. And it was the Nasdaq bubble time, and we were listing new companies. Of course, the Nasdaq bubble burst, and Greenwich unfortunately dissolved, and I was sent on my way. And I joined a firm called AngloRandom. I'd been there for about a week, sitting in a room with guys which I didn't know that well. And one of them one morning said to me, "Would you like to come to the Cashbuild shareholders presentation?" I said, "Cashbuild, I'd not heard of it." But I thought, oh, the phone's not ringing, and I might as well go and learn something. So we arrive at the Cashbuild shareholders meeting, presentation, you know, for investors. And he and I are the only two people there. Pat Goldrick's there, and he introduces himself. And now I'm furious with myself because I don't really know what business Cashbuild is in. And he said, "Well, you know, there's no one's turned up. Let's go and have lunch." We sat down with himself and the FD, and we sat around speaking about the company. And Cashbuild was trading. It had fallen, and they'd brought Pat in from Ireland to turn the business around. And he explained the whole hardware business and how they were going to expand and the size of the market which they were going to try to penetrate. So I ended up buying shares at about 3 Rand or 4 Rand a share. And eventually sold it. That was around 2001. Ended up selling it in about 2003 for about 55 Rand a share. That's the nice part of the story. The sad part is, I think, as you probably know, Cashbuild ended up going as high as 500 Rand a share. So as close as I was to the story, I still couldn't believe my eyes when I saw it 55 Rand. And eventually it was spinning off dividends of, you know, 2 or 3 Rand a year. So I would have got my money back in dividends as well. Unfortunately, I put quite a few of the clients into the share. And it sort of stood me in good stead. You know, the clients sort of, "Oh, this is the guy that found us Cashbuild." So it had many positive spin-offs, that relationship.
Okay, well, that's a wonderful story. And yeah, that's been a great company. I mean, obviously been affected by the downturn in the economy more recently.
Yes, the share price is pulled. I was looking at it today. It's back to about 130 Rand. Yeah.
So it's, you know, had that massive run up, but it's not been immune. And I mean, it is a company that grew quite aggressively. And I think obviously has been, like so many other companies, a bit victim of the Zuma years in South Africa and the very weak economic environment that we've seen in the country. And if we then move on to your worst trade.
Yeah, I was actually looking up the dates when I saw your email with the questions. So what happened in about 2007? And I mean, just remember the market had been on a tear from about 2002 to 2000, and obviously the crash, which kind of first signs were 2007, eventually took place in probably about May or June of 2008. Prime Media was listed then, and the share price had been slowly improving, been in the mid-teens of the 17, 18, 19. And eventually it was announced that there was going to be a share buyout at about 24 Rand a share. And this was a valuable lesson. And so I saw it was like trading at 21. I did the time value of money calculation, you know, how long before I got my money back, and then I geared myself and I bought as many Prime Media shares as I could carry in my carry account. But I didn't look through carefully enough at, you know, the salient features of the deal. And there was a bond that was trading in Europe, and that bond had to stay above a certain level, otherwise the deal would fall through. And obviously I paid 20 odd Rand for the share. The deal fell through, the share would have probably fallen back to 15. And so I was right on my limit with my margin. And then for one day that bond came below, once the market started to crash in Europe, it came below, the share dropped a couple of Rand. I had a huge margin call. I've sold. And about a week later, the deal went through at the 24 Rand. So the lesson there was, make sure you do your homework properly. And if you're going to put a lot of money down the table, understand all of the risks, do the homework. Don't just take the brochure and throw it in the back of the car and look at it later. You have to know what you're doing, because there's always something which you haven't thought of with the market.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. I was also caught up in that exact same trade. I'm smiling now while you're talking about it because I think so many of us that were in the market exactly. And that bond, I'm just racking my brain now trying to think what the damn thing was called. Yeah. Because unfortunately, I haven't got it. It's on the tip of my tongue. But, you know, it was something that none of us had ever heard of. And then all of a sudden, we all became fixated on this one bond.
We became experts
on this one thing that was, you know, that this whole deal hinged around this one particular bond. I remember that very, very well, and I also remember sweating like crazy on that trade as well, because I think all of us in the market were in it, because like you said, it looked like a slam dunk and an opportunity to make some easy money.
It's always the case. You've got to look at it from, you know, worst case scenario, you've got to price in. But also, as I was saying, my trading strategy, you always keep enough margin for a worst case.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson, is that you've always got to remember, and it's what Mark Douglas says in his book, Trading in the Zone, that remember anything can happen in the market. And and like that, you know, even the most unexpected thing can happen. And for that reason, you've got to always just, you know, be careful of how much leverage you take on, because in the event that some sort of black swan happens, you don't want to be wiped out. And
this year has been the best example ever. You've had two black swans. You've had obviously the virus, and you've had the oil price collapsing. So, and I mean, beginning of this year, none of us would have even occurred to us. We thought, well, the oil's around 55. That's probably where it's going to be for the rest of the year. And look, you know, look what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. Just two more questions before we wrap up, Greg. A lot of us in the market love to read trading books. And I've been asking all the candidates on these interviews if they've got a favorite trading book that they would recommend. Have you got one in mind that springs to the, you know, top of your head immediately?
Yeah, there's so many, and obviously people must read, you know, like Warren Buffett's books and so on. But my favorite is The Alchemy of Finance. It's George Soros. I don't know if he's updated it, but it's just so many lessons in there. Obviously, a massive hedge fund manager and quite a controversial character of late, but just fascinating insights. I'm actually a bit lazy, so I actually downloaded the audio book, and I went for long walks and with my headphones on. You end up walking an extra 5 kilometers. I'm just amazed at the amount of knowledge that you can, you know, gain from the wisdom that's in these books is amazing.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think that's lazy at all. I think that's actually very good utilization of your time. You're getting some exercise and you're getting some intellectual stimulation at the same time.
Mind is not on the how hot you are walking around. Yeah,
exactly. In fact, most of the books I consume now are actually audio books, because you can do it while you're...
Get through a lot more, really.
It. Yeah. I mean, if I go to the gym and I'm running on the treadmill, I'll listen to an audio book. Or if I'm catching the train into London here, I'll listen to an audio book. Or dare I say, even if I'm cleaning my house now that I live in the UK and have domestics in here to help us.
Yeah.
You know, so I find myself putting my headset on, and actually, you know, while I'm vacuuming the house, I listen to an audiobook, and it's actually, instead of it being a complete, you know, useless waste of time, it becomes productive time to listen to an audiobook while you're doing something else. So, yeah.
I think all traders like to be able to do two things at the same time.
Yeah, indeed. So last question then, Greg, before we wrap up is, you guys at Kratos do get a lot of youngsters that come in there and take up a desk and start trading. If someone, a youngster, came to you and said, look, I want to start trading. This is a career that I want to get involved with. What two or three pieces of advice would you give to a youngster starting in this business?
Yeah, I've sort of sat in on those meetings, and really it's tough. And I mean, the guy which runs that division always says to these young traders, you can come and sit here and you can trade, but you've got to say to yourself, if you're doing trading for a living, you might go 18 months without an income. And if you can't do that, then you mustn't trade. So you do get youngsters still sort of, you know, with their parents and that kind of thing. Or people have got into their 30s, sold a business, built up a lot of capital, which they can fall back on. So trading for a living is really tough. I suppose all the basics, really, risk, stop losses are so important you know, in everything. Even my long-term equity stocks, probably something it's taken me a long time to learn, but as much as you love a share, you still got to have a stop loss for it, even if you've said, I'm keeping this until I retire. But on the trading, I think it's probably read a lot of books, spend time talking to successful traders, asking them, you know, for advice, or would you see, you know, what level would you get in, what level would you get out? So as much time as you can spend around experienced traders, I think that's probably the key.
Yeah, great advice. Well, that's it then, Greg. We've run out of time, so I'm going to wrap up the interview there. It's really been fascinating talking to you. I knew it would be. It's always great talking to guys that have got such a lengthy experience in the market. So thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. I think the listeners are in for a treat listening to this podcast when it comes up in the next couple of weeks.
Great. Thanks, Garth.
Take care, Greg. Thanks so much.
Great. All the best. Ciao.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.